Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Thursday, January 10th. I'm Ray Graff. It's the Science Forum today, and I must tell you, in full disclosure, the scientists have been doing show prep today. So today's show may be something extra special. If you have a science question today, the number is 800-348-2551, 800-348-2551. We have our trio of geniuses here to answer your questions. VoxPop@WAMC.org if you'd like to email. Otherwise, the number 800-348-2551. The Science Forum and your calls coming up on Vox Pop right after some news. Hello again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. Today we reconvene the Science Forum, and our experts are here and ready to answer your questions. The number to call is 800-348-2551, 800-348-2551. Of course, if you wish, if you're the shy retiring type, email voxpop@wamc.org, voxpop@wamc.org. But again, that number, 800-348-2551. 2551. Let's have our panel of scientists sign in, please.
Hi, I'm Jim Pickett. I'm an organic chemist, and I never get to go first.
You see, I was trying to give you a little treat. Well, welcome, Jim.
And I'm I can't deal with this. Ed Stander, SUNY Cobell Skill, geology, astronomy, and anything Jim can't answer.
And privileged to be last, it's Barbara Brabetz. I'm a biochemist at SUNY Cobell Skill.
Well, I printed some things out for the program.
Thank you.
And Ed immediately mocked them as I walk in Studio A and said, "This is dreck." But I thought this article from science.com about monogamy may have a telltale signature of gene activity was cracking good stuff.
I'm trying to make a pun between cracking and gene activity or cracking and monogamy, and I haven't quite figured it out yet.
All right. Well, it's a long show.
Yeah, we've got some time. We'll come up with one-liners.
Is this any good, Barbara Brabetz?
I think the basis of this article, which is about three pages and is dated three days ago, it tells a really long story in a pretty short summary, but the idea is they took behaviors of animals, which we've done for a long time, and we try to categorize them or put them in bundles. And we've used like that whole idea of behavior to kind of put things in bins for a long time in science. Well, now it's kind of coupling that with genes. What is in their genome that is similar to their activity, which we see is also similar? And they've come up with some contenders of areas within the genome that may be quote-unquote monogamy genes. Mm. Now, that doesn't mean they are. It could be that their genes, they could be coincidence.
Right.
It could be that they have common social behaviors beyond monogamy that have some redundancy. But it means there's something to explore there.
Yeah.
And in this day and age of computers and relatively cheap biotech procedures, we can further query this.
So this is only the beginning of this.
Right. I looked at the last page to see, what about humans?
Right.
Do we have the genes? It's not in the article.
Oh, okay. Well,
unfortunate.
I think some people have the gene, right?
It could be. Let's hope so. We're more than the sum of our genome, and some people are less than the sum of their genome.
But right, you are about that.
Yeah, I've got some old boyfriends that are certainly less than their old genome.
And there's a joke right there, right?
Oh, yeah.
Jim Pickett also brought some show prep for you, Barbara, and this is about photosynthesis and hacking photosynthesis. I don't even know what that means.
So I've been trying to think of how to do this without getting in the weeds, ba-dum-bum, with photosynthesis.
I see what you did there.
What happened is some researchers at the University of Illinois worked on looking at the very complex multiple steps of photosynthesis,
right,
which is where we harness energy from the sun,
mm-hmm,
in chloroplasts mostly, in order to create carbon sources that we eat, or that plants use as stored energy, and then we ultimately eat. So, you know, back to the Twinkie, it all came from stars. Strange but true. And there are some inefficiencies in the photosynthetic process, and the cells have to do a kind of a cleanup crew and fix problems that have gone awry within the photosynthetic cascade. And one of them is the formation of a poison called glycolate, and it's poisonous to the cell. And so what it does is it sticks extra oxygen on the glycolate and gets it out of the cell, kind of puts it in handcuffs, you know, think of two O's.
What this hack does, you mean?
No, the real cells.
Okay.
Do this. They put these O's on the glycolate and then they ship it out. So it's very intensive. You got to move it through the cell. You've got to sacrifice oxygen, which you don't necessarily always have, and you got to get it out. And what this does is it sequesters the poison early, and then the hack adds enzymes from other species that are not plant-like. One of them is a microbe, and another one is from pumpkin, and then puts them into tobacco, and then look to see how efficient it grew. So first of all, did it work? Did the handcuffing of the poison in the locality that it's created work? And then what happened to the plant overall? Because even if we fixed photosynthesis, but it didn't make the plant better, why go through the trouble? So, Jim, did you want to take it from there?
I don't think there's too much more to say that it appeared to work.
Worked.
All right, well, it worked. And my question is, what is a practical... In other words, it's all very nice for you science types, but for those of us who are, say, broadcasters and of limited intellect at that, what is the practical thing we can do with
cheaper cigarettes?
Well,
now you have my attention.
Well, they did tobacco apparently because it's easy to work with tobacco.
And the genome is completely hacked.
Yeah,
I mean,
but
ultimately, know the genome of tobacco before we know most other plants.
But ultimately, what that would mean is that a square meter of green leaves could produce more stuff.
Yeah.
Or grow faster.
So they got 40% heavier plants by using this re-engineered genetic trick.
Yep. So the trick will be doing the same thing for food plants, and then food production may or may not be made much more efficient.
Right.
But it could also work, say, for energy-producing plants. You do
Correct.
This on switchgrass for
or algae.
For bioenergy or algae. But just kind of fixing this...
mistake, effectively.
It's helping evolution.
It's a glitch,
along.
And it just increases the efficiency of photosynthesis, and you can do a lot with that.
What could go wrong?
It could not work. I mean, that's usually what happens.
Well, it seems to work, but what could there be a detrimental effect? Let's say in the food chain.
They're naturally occurring enzymes that already are in a food chain. It's just kind of making a patchwork quilt of the enzymes and putting them all in one place rather than having one blanket of one type and one blanket of another. You've got kind of the fuzzy part and the silky part all in the same quilt.
And you would want to keep it out of plants like crabgrass and kudzu.
Oh, that's a good plant.
Bamboo.
Yeah. I mean, it could go wrong by getting it into plants. I think
it would produce super weeds much faster than any other direction.
Here. Right. And the big question in my mind is most of the parts of vegetables that we eat are the fruit product, they're the babies, right? So if it makes more green leaves, will that also mean bigger fruit or more fruit, more food stuff that actually ends up on our plate?
Mm-hmm.
If we have a taller corn stalk, but the corn is the same size, that doesn't really help.
Yeah. But what it could do is, like, for example, I know about growing corn. Basically, it's reaching a limit on how much corn you can make for a given amount of surface area of green leaves.
Correct.
If you can get more bang out of that same square meters of green leaves, that would increase the yields. If it is reflected in increasing the amount of seeds and fruiting bodies. That, to my mind, is the big question.
And if you don't mind just a speculation of where this could go a little longer, with global climate change, we're having arable lands shrink in the United States. We're going further north with our arable land, and the south is becoming less arable. This will allow you to grow the same amount or more amount of food, potentially, in a smaller acreage.
Ah. Our number here is 800-348-2551. It's the Science Forum. Barbara Brabets is here, Jim Pickett, and Ed Stander. They're here to answer your questions. So let's take a question, and then we'll take a break. Rod in East Nassau. Rod, you're on.
Hi. I'm wondering, has it been scientifically proven that high fructose corn syrup disrupts the brain's function of letting you know when you are full?
I don't know what proven means, but there's evidence to that effect. There's also evidence that it creates an insulin response that's not normal. And that can be one, again, kind of connect the dots, that is a suspect in why obesity is such a problem in the United States these days, is that if you look at the same caloric intake, high fructose versus other sugars, you end up with more obese lab animals, for example.
And also, high fructose corn syrup is so poorly metabolized by the body that it winds up collecting in the liver. And one of the main reasons for fatty liver that we have right now is because of the high fructose corn syrup. So it has a lot of effects on the body, and whether it has... There actually has been suggestions that one of the reasons for dementia can be that the brain is not able to assimilate high fructose corn syrup the way it can with sugar. And so by using a lot of high fructose corn syrup, you can wind up actually starving the brain.
Right, and over-insulin response. The brain gets that same insulin response, like, oh, something sweet is coming down from the taste buds, but then there's not the glucose delivery that comes afterwards because fructose and glucose are different.
Mm-hmm. All right, Rod, we'll have to take a break here. It's the Science Forum. Our number is 800-348-2551. We've only just begun. Many more questions and hopefully some answers coming up. Welcome back to Vox Pop on WAMC. Ray Graff with you. 800-348-2551 is the number. It's the Science Forum. Jim Pickett, Barbara Brabets, and Ed Stander are here. Well, you're all very smart. How hot do you reckon it is here in Studio A?
You want it in Fahrenheit or Celsius?
Well, let's Kelvin. Go Kelvin.
Let's have it in Kelvin. Yeah.
Kelvin? Million Kelvin. It's million Kelvin in here.
It's a little warm in here. And it's funny. It's very cool out in the hallway.
Oh, it's because our brains are working at such high levels.
Is that what it is?
It's all the fructose.
You know, it seemed warm before you got in, but I'll take that. Let's go to Dieter in LaGrange. Dieter, don't turn the lights out, Ed. Thank you. Dieter, you're on.
All right. Quick question. Water softener, normally they use sodium salt, and I heard that using potassium chloride might be better for the groundwater when this thing goes through its cycles. Is that true?
Well, you put out about 40. So, yeah, a typical softener takes solar salt, which is mostly sodium chloride, and it has an exchange in the water between the +2, +3 metal ions that are in your water for the +1 ions of sodium. So not to get too chemistry, but that's pretty much the two sodiums for a magnesium, for example, or three sodiums for an iron. That's kind of how it goes. When that sodium gets ejected, it's about 40 to 60 gallons, depending on the size of your softener and its efficiency, that is ejected back into either the sewer or into your dry well / septic system. Ultimately, there's a lot of salt in human waste as well. So it's just one of many sodium inputs to your sanitary sewer or septic system. And it's got a lot of water.
How about potassium?
Chloride be better than that?
No, it's really not.
We had to well test it.
Yeah, what we find is that the sodium and the potassium, there are certain people who have a sensitivity to one or the other based upon some organ issues that they might have, whether that be heart or kidney. You know, potassium's no shining star when it comes to, you know, health. If you have a potassium sensitivity, you're going to be just as much at risk. So it's actually better if we don't over-soften or we don't recharge our systems as frequently as we need to. There's some other options besides softening, too, but softening is cheap and reliable and accessible to most people.
And I would mention that I've got a water softener at my house. I just keep it unplugged. And when you go in the shower and you find the soap comes off very, very easily because the calcium is more common than the sodium at that point, you recharge this water softener. I do it maybe once every 2 months.
There you go. Let's go back to the phones and John in Albany. John.
Hi. I actually have a quick question regarding temperature.
Oh, good.
So when it's hot and humid out, that's the worst, obviously. It gets too hot because you can't sweat, and if you do sweat, it doesn't get carried away. But why is it when it's cold and humid, it's colder than when it's cold and dry?
Don't all jump at once.
I don't have a good answer for that.
Well, we've had this question, but it was so long ago. I'm trying to remember how we answered it to everyone's satisfaction because it resulted in a fight with a previous science forum expert. Evaporation is still evaporation, right? So if you have a warm body and you're taking a cold shower, for example, versus a hot shower. If you're a warm body and you've got cold water falling on you when you're hot, the water's still going to evaporate. It's not going to evaporate very efficiently, but it's still going to evaporate. And when it does, it is going to take your heat away. So you perceive yourself to be colder.
Yeah.
It's not actually colder, right? It's just the temperature that it is. But it's that perception because you're losing heat to the evaporative process. You don't have that same evaporative process going on in dry circumstances. So dry, cold, you don't have the water leaving you.
Okay.
So when it's cold and humid, it's sort of condensing on your skin and then evaporating off?
Well, you're if the humidity is high enough, like it has been recently around here in upstate New York, if you have any skin that's involved, yes, you're in contact with the moisture droplets that are actually physically in the air. They're not condensing on you per se, but you're running into them and then they're evaporating off of you. Think of a misty night, right? That's the worst.
Okay. Well, John, thanks a lot. Anybody want to follow up on that?
Yeah, it was good talking. Good hearing from you, John. I hope you're having a good day at home. That was my son.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Why didn't you jump in earlier? Jeepers creepers. All right. Let's go to line 4. Abaye in New York City. You're on.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
So I had a quick question. I heard on a previous program that they've linked vitamin B12 deficiency to possibly dementia or Alzheimer's. And what I'd read in a reference to a study that some people might have difficulty synthesizing vitamin B12 that's like synthetic. I know it's commonly added to flour or wheat flour because they sort of add that as a supplement. And I was wondering if you think there might be a link between sort of the prevalence of that in our food and people's ability or vitamin B12 deficiency.
I can tell you one thing about it is that vitamin B12, first of all, we use extremely little of it. And if you are running a vitamin B deficiency, then you wind up having to take much more than is normally available. Your body, once it's had a deficiency, it becomes much more difficult to assimilate. So you wind up having to take much more. So as far as that goes, if you run a deficiency like I have had in the past, you have to take the supplements in order to keep it up to the right level. Now, what effect that would have on the body, that's a whole other story.
And there's kind of a vicious circle with B12 because your digestive system converts B12 into the form that it can absorb, but it affects, if you have a B12 deficiency, it affects the absorption of vitamins in your intestine. So you need your intestine to be working correctly to absorb the B12 that it needs to work correctly. So often what you can do is supplement with sublingual B12. There's a B12 supplement, many of them over the market, over the counter, that you put drops under your tongue, and then that goes transdermally through your skin under your tongue and into your system so that it bypasses the problematic digestive system.
Aha.
Or you can get the shots, which are much more effective and have like a 3-month window. Otherwise, people take the B12 drops daily or weekly.
I know my grandmother's a big advocate of the vitamin B shots.
Yes. They make you feel great.
And I'll tell you, if you don't want the shots or the lingual drops, brewer's yeast is the way to go. If you can find one that tastes good, it's very high in folic acid.
Huh. Well, thank you very much for the call, and we appreciate it. Our number here is 800-348-2551. It's the Science Forum with Ed Stander, Jim Pickett, and Barbara Brabets. Don and Gardner. Don, you're on.
Oh, hi. With the recent retrospectives about the Apollo 8 mission, which 50 years ago circumnavigated the moon for the first time, I was reminded how when they went around to the dark side, the far side of the moon, there was a gap in communication between the Apollo and the Earth. They couldn't communicate back. So I'm wondering how the recent Chinese probe, which I think has landed on the dark side of the moon, how is that communicating with the engineers back on Earth?
It's
Anybody?
Pretty simple. There's a relay. There's a relay satellite. It's sending the signal to a relay satellite that then sends it to the Earth.
a relay satellite around the moon or around the Earth?
Which is going around the moon but is off to the side so that it's able to get a signal both from the satellite, from the probe, and to the Earth.
Is it just sitting
there at
a Lagrange point?
Two crafts that went up.
Yep.
Correct.
That's right.
And the satellite went up first, yep, I believe.
I think so, yeah.
And it's sitting at about where you would consider a dusk or a dawn point for the moon, so where it could still be within sight of the sun and the Earth.
Yeah, so and it's not really in orbit. It's sitting in a place where the gravitational forces of this Earth and the moon cancel out, so it can just kind of hover, hang out there.
Right.
All right.
There is a probe on the moon, correct?
Yes. Mm-hmm. And there's a satellite in space.
And has there been any useful science coming back regarding that probe, what it's found so far?
It's Chinese. It may take a little while.
Before we find out.
Okay. In fact, even with American probes, the data usually goes to the scientist working on it, and they may not let it out for several months or years before it comes out in public.
A lot of the Mars information that we got, which was retrieved in a similar fashion, didn't come out until we saw in the literature, the scientific literature that we've referenced today, in some of the more popular magazines like Science or Nature. Hmm.
Thank you for the call, Don. The number here is 800-348-2551. And over to Bob in Brunswick. Bob.
Hi. Just thought I'd get the geologists involved here.
Thank heavens.
What you think about a gene superiority by geology story. Say, so 66 million years ago, a 6 mile wide meteor hits the Yucatan Peninsula and creates a 100 mile crater that causes all kinds of octanic activity, dust in the atmosphere, low oxygen levels, and 90% of the living creatures die and become extinct, except for what seems to be a distant ancestor of the dinosaurs, which is birds, which happen to survive.
Well, not just birds, but mammals got a big boost up as a result of that.
Yeah, there were other ones too, right. So.
Yeah, so it's not a really genetic superiority, but we had little animals that were running around that were able to survive in an environment where there wasn't a lot of food left.
Or oxygen.
Well, that's hard to say because that's not the Permian extinction, we lost oxygen, but during the Cretaceous, there wasn't. The Cretaceous, there wasn't that much of a problem. So, yeah, there was not a lot of food except for a lot of dead dinosaurs, perhaps. Mm. And they were living underground. So it was a pretty good environment for them to survive. A situation where it was dark outside because there was so much dust in the environment. And it was probably raining quite a bit of sulfuric acid. The acid rain was probably bad at that point because of the amount of sulfur in the water or in the environment around the Yucatan Peninsula. So it was the safest thing for them. So it probably wasn't genetic as much as just chance that those creatures took off and the reason that we're here talking on the radio today.
Bob, thanks for the call. It's the Science Forum on WAMC. Number is 800-348-2551. Justin in Waterville Heights. Justin.
Hi, yeah. I had a question about the genetic. I actually caught your program halfway through, so hopefully this is relevant. I had a question about the genetic modification of the plants to give them a leg up. I was wondering if anyone was concerned about them getting into any specific environment and taking over and really ruining the homeostasis that has been achieved there already, especially with the algae blooms or the super algae blooms that they've had in Florida.
Yeah, I mean, I think that this would be a technology that needs to be exploited very, very cautiously because of just that. Said you don't want to get this into an invasive plant that's going to take over. But agricultural plants, and it would need to be demonstrated that the genes pretty well stay put where they're intended to be and not get spread around much. Okay. So, yeah, there are lots of ways there's lots of ways any kind of technology can go wrong. And it just needs to be thought through pretty carefully.
Yeah, we've seen that happening with the BT plants where there were an awful lot of brassicas around in the past. And now we're stuck with certain ones, but those those weeds, the nuisible ones that are still out there, are starting to pick up the same features that the BT process allows them to grow faster. So it's a very dangerous situation in that respect. It's hard to keep things hidden away.
Justin, thank you for that one. It's 800-348-2551. Barbara Brabitz is here, Jim Pickett, and Ed Stander. It's the Science Forum. And now, oh boy, it's going to be a regular occurrence. We go to our old buddy Jim in North Pownell. Jim, you're on.
Hi, Ray. Hi, scientists.
Hello, Jim.
I need to weigh in on water softener discharges. It should never, ever be directed into a septic tank. I have seen more septic tanks where their baffles were rotted out by the water softener discharge. The best place to put water softener discharge is into a secondary dry well or to just direct it to daylight, but never, ever should it be put into a septic tank.
Well, I did mention a dry well, and I said or septic tank, because some people don't have a dry well, Jim. And then also some zoning does not allow discharge out onto the surface.
Yeah, I know. It should be allowed to discharge to daylight, and you just plant some salt-tolerant plants around it and let them suck it up, you know. But never, ever put it into a septic tank. It'll destroy the tank.
What happens is, if it does happen to go into a septic tank, it will mingle with the solids, and a lot of that will, it's not filter out, but it'll kind of agglomerate together and then end up in the solids, which are eventually pumped.
Okay.
It'll rot the concrete baffles. I've seen it so many times, you can't believe it. I've been in public health for 50 years. And I have seen it in Connecticut, I've seen it in Vermont, I've seen it in New York. The softener discharge actually rots the baffles in a septic tank.
Hey, Jim, are you fighting a cold? Are you fighting a bug?
Yeah.
Come on, man. You got to have some medicine, maybe a little tea, and relax. And thanks for the call, buddy. We'll see you next time. Over to DeWitt in Kingston. DeWitt, you're on.
Yes, this is a hyper-technical question, and I really hope you guys can handle it.
All right.
Why does seltzer fizz more violently when you pour it into a glass loaded with ice as opposed to just a straight open container glass?
Surface area.
We've had this one before, thanks to it.
I could go for a
Ed's suggestion of surface area and probably roughness
on
the ice provides nucleation sites for the bubbles to form.
Like little seed bubbles.
Yes.
Yes.
Oh, okay.
So my guess would be that here's an experiment for you.
Oh, this is great.
Yeah, you can do an experiment. Take two glasses, one with ice straight out of the ice maker. The other one, rinse the ice first with a little water.
Hot water, with a little warm water.
With a little warm water to smooth it off.
All right.
And put that in a glass. And then pour the soda in and see which fizzes more.
Interesting.
And then report back with the results.
So maybe you do that on the next show, DeWitt? Give us a report back?
Yeah, there's another.
Observe and report back.
There's another part to it, though, is that as soon as you start getting bubbles, they form cavitation on the ice, and that produces more bubbles.
Oh.
So it would only be the first couple seconds you'd be able to see a difference.
Yeah, but that's really what, you know, when you're pouring it in and getting that whoosh effect that then goes all over the counter.
Yeah,
you know?
Yes, it does.
First effect.
All right, you have your homework, DeWitt. Thank you for the call. The number's 800-348-2551. Sasha in Woodstock. Sasha, you're on.
Hi, take your speakerphone.
Splendid.
Hear me all right?
Yeah, sure.
Okay. So, hi, you guys. Yes. Well, there are certain substances that are in our foods and quite pervasive and for decades, and you know the common ones, partially and totally hydrogenated vegetable oils, monoglycerides, high fructose corn syrup, all the usual suspects. Which I'm 60 years old. I heard ages ago on the radio and in newspapers I read that these things were going to stop being produced and put into foods in this country. And now it's years for some, decades for some later, and they're still all over the place. And do you guys know why? And thank you so much, Supreme Scientists and Ray.
Thank you.
Wow.
What do you think, panel?
Well, I'm going to give you the good news. The good news is we now have truth in labeling. So we have mandatory labeling so that informed consent, you can go around and look to see what has partially hydrogenated or totally hydrogenated vegetable oil, what has trans fats in it versus cis fats, what has high fructose corn syrup versus another sugar. All of that is on the label. And in fact, the manufacturers have gotten swift because it does vary a bit from state to state, is that they go with whoever has the highest regulations and then changes their labeling to that one, and then we all benefit.
So California,
so if
basically.
California says, I need to know how many milligrams of high fructose corn syrup are in this Coca-Cola, then it's going to be on the outside on the front. So that's the good news. So we still have to be savvy shoppers and slightly scientific in how we go about doing this. I also think that a lot of the food chains have gotten onto this, and many of them in our area can give you nutritional ratings on the label that's on the actual shelf of the grocery store. So you can look to see what looks like a health food on the label, like juices, for example. But then you look underneath it, and it gives you a real health rating that a scientist has created. And that will help eliminate some of the deceptions in labeling.
Right.
We'll have to take a quick break here. It's the Science Forum on WAMC. 800-348-2551 is our telephone number. Barbara, Jim, and Ed are here, and they will hit the home stretch when we return. Vox Pop, WAMC, 800-348-2551, the Science Forum. And before we get to the email and then back to the phones, just tell us, what is, in fact, partially
hydrogenated
vegetable oil? Hydrogenated. What is that?
So you can get oils that have, oh gosh, Jim, you want to do this? It's chemistry, but single bonds or double bonds.
Yep. And a lot of vegetable oils will have, okay, the fats are little chains of carbon that are 12 to 18 carbons long.
Okay.
If all of the bonds between the carbons are single bonds, one little line, that's saturated.
Okay.
Okay. So if you have a fat like that, you get something like beef tallow. It's mostly saturated.
Okay.
And its melting point is a little higher, and it tends to congeal.
Yep.
So think of like the Crisco can, or think of the stuff that your mother would drain off the bacon.
And it tastes really good and feels good in your mouth, and that's why people love it.
Okay.
Okay. So plants will have double bonds in the backbone, and even better, they have double bonds that put a kink in the chains.
Okay.
So they don't line up well and make them more liquidy. And apparently that's better for
our cells. Better for
your cells and better for your blood vessels. Okay. So to make shortening, so margarine or Crisco out of the plant oil, because it's cheap, they add hydrogen across that double bond and make it a single bond.
Why is that bad?
What's bad is when that goes on, some of those double bonds, rather than being kinked, go straight. So you have a double bond, but now it's rigid and straight, and those pack together really well.
And the body doesn't know what to do with them because they're foreign. They're not a natural product.
So that's what's the so-called trans fat. And it generally doesn't occur naturally. It occurs in the chemistry of hydrogenating the vegetable oil, although it doesn't have to, and I think the hydrogenated oils have much less of that now, or can have much less of that.
So when you say the body doesn't know what to do with it, then the body does not metabolize it? It goes right through?
Well, we wish. It packs them into the sides of your arteries. And what you do is, if you have somebody who has arterial disease and they have calcifications, plaques within the arteries, it started with a fatty deposit first. And then that fatty deposit gets infused with calcium, and it becomes a hardening of the arteries.
I gotcha.
What we find is, if you take a molecular look at what the fats were that were there, they're the artificial fats that we get from our diet from this hydrogenation process. They're selectively put, kind of like shoving peas under your placemat at dinner. It doesn't know what to do with them, so it packs them into the side of the artery, and we get plaques.
It's just like the corn syrup we started out with.
Yeah, so we have unintended effects.
Well, now I understand something. Thank you very much for that. Over to Mark in Salem. Mark, you're on.
Hi, Ray. How are you?
Good. And yourself?
Happy New Year.
And to you.
I go back to the question. First of all, I'll give you an update on my solar hot water system.
Oh, yeah.
I've got an 80-gallon tank full of 125-degree water. That cost me 150 watts. Per hour. So the old-fashioned time when President Carter was pushing it, it still works, and we save a lot of money.
Okay.
The question I go back to is the feeling of feeling extra cold when the temperature goes down and the relative humidity is high. Hmm. And that, I think... If you think of it in terms of now, bear with me, absolute humidity versus relative humidity, and your scientists should know the difference. The amount of water in the volume of space stays the same, and as you go down in temperature, the relative humidity goes up, and as a result, your barometric pressure drops. Because water is lighter than water vapor, displaces the heavier atoms, and it causes you to, like that's why flies don't do well when it's very humid weather. The air is less dense, and so your body responds to that in a way because of the drop in barometric pressure and also the drop or the increase in the relative humidity. If they want to add anything to that.
You guys want to add anything to that?
Nope.
I think you did very well, Mark. Thank you, sir. We appreciate the call. This one, by the way, came in via email during the break. This one is from Mike. And Mike writes, help, I've been lied to always and told that space was a vacuum. Turns out that, in fact, space contains almost half the mass of the entire galaxy. What is the effect of this, and how does it play into our understanding of dark matter / energy? Many thanks from Mike in Hudson.
Well, the problem is that space is empty as far as there's two things in the universe, supposedly. There is what we call machos, which are anything made out of atoms, and wimps, which are anything that's made up of everything else.
He's not kidding. That's really what they're called.
They're called machos and wimps. And the wimps are the things which supposedly fill space between the machos. We don't know if they have any mass.
So this is the bubbling quantum-ish stuff.
This is neutrinos, whatever they might be, or something like those. And they're there, and they fill up space, but they don't seem to have any mass. And so as a result, while space is empty, it's filled
of
mass. We don't know what these things are that are sort of surrounding it. This is very complicated.
It is very complicated. And I know Voyager is now way
past
the edge of the solar system. Right. And it's actually looking into this whole thing about a theory that there are a lot of tiny little black holes out in space that make up a portion of the mass that they call dark matter.
With like early 1970s technology. Good for V'ger, you know?
V'ger from Star Trek. Mm-hmm. Okay, I'm with you on that reference. Let's go back to the phones. And we go to Daniel in Boyceville. Daniel, you're on.
Oh, thanks. I have a large cache of stone cairns on my property that I mapped. And there are 13 rows with 28 mounds. They're like 6 feet high, six feet diameter, maybe 10 to 20 feet apart. And those rows all are east-west. So in looking at it, it seemed like it would be a calendar since it's pretty much accounts for all the days of the year. And then we go out there on the solstice and the shadow does a thing where it goes from one mound to the next, but it's off and slightly. Somebody recommended that maybe it's a lunar calendar and that might line up, but it's very hard to see shadows at night. And I haven't really been able to do that. I was wondering if there was a an angle that a shadow would cast from the moon, a certain angle that I'd be able to be looking for, some number of degrees different than the shadow during the day.
The moon is off from the ecliptic, from the sun by 12 degrees.
Okay.
Now, from that, it would be really hard to actually calculate what the angle would be at that particular location. How tall are the mounds?
6 feet.
6 feet tall.
That is so cool, by the way.
It's about a 2-acre area in the Catskills, Boyceville.
And it's flat?
No, it's on the side of an incline. They're absolutely, every one of them is a work of art. Whoever built them put a lot of effort into it.
That is amazing.
Obviously.
And, of course, the incline complicates the measurements of where the shadow will fall.
Yeah, there is, most of it is on a fairly flat area, only probably 5 degrees or so. And then some of it is on a hillside, but the bulk of that matrix, which I mapped, is on that. It's pretty flat.
And you're sure these are not, for example?
I'm waiting for a full moon on the solstice where there's no clouds, and it just hasn't happened in years.
Ed, you had a question.
No, I'm just wondering. You're sure they're not Indian burial mounds, for example? Which
I had
several
Native American groups come by, and they said that burial grounds would be a much more, they didn't want to draw attention to burial mounds, so they were, always very discreet. Whereas this is more of a some kind of public works thing. It's for whatever reason they made something that really stood out in the landscape.
Well, if you'll send your coordinates to the to WAMC, I'll look into it myself.
Okay, our email address is voxpop@wamc.org, and if you send those along, we'll put you in touch with Ed. And I tell you what, Daniel, that's a great call and very interesting indeed. Fascinated by that stuff. Eric in Hudson. Eric, you're on. Okay. Hello.
Hello. Hi. Hi. Thank you. I love your show. I've never been a caller before.
Oh, well, welcome
show,
aboard.
So thank you. actually, I'm calling because I'm very curious about the quality of light.
Your connection's pretty bad. You said the quality of light, and then we lost you. Go ahead, do it again.
Well, I'm sorry. The quality of light, either on the light side of the moon or anywhere, in space about as far away as the moon is, how does light appear to people? Does it seem like daytime, in a sense, like it does here?
Well, the only real difference, and you can see this actually in the photographs that were taken on the moon, is that light on the moon is much brighter, it's much whiter than it is on Earth. Because on Earth, the light gets scattered by particles in the atmosphere, and the blue gets scattered separately from the rest. So as a result, the light is a lot more mellow, a lot yellower on the Earth than it would be on the moon. The temperature of the sun is about 5,200 degrees Kelvin. And you can buy light bulbs, effectively, that have that color temperature. And if you look at them, that's what the light looks like from the moon.
Oh, that's interesting.
Wow. Yeah, if you search any search engine or shopping engine for a 5,200 Kelvin light, you'll get the sun approximation light bulbs. You can buy them, and they're cheap.
Amazing. And can you see stars at the same time or no?
On the dark side, you can.
No, right. Yeah, I think during
the dark,
in the day. If you're not looking in the direction of the sun on the moon, you see stars. Yeah.
Okay. Eric, connection not all that great, so we'll let you go there, but that's another good call. And we go to Julie in New Hartford.
Hey, guys. How are you doing?
Well, hanging in there. How about you?
Well, not too bad. That's kind of surviving the cold weather out here in central New York. So since you had a geologist on board, I thought I would ask a geology question.
Great.
Well, I'm a hiker. I've especially in the Northeast, I've probably done more than, 1,000 mountain ascents in the Northeast and beyond. And I write about my hikes and I'm kind of fascinated by the shapes of mountains. And I had a shape of mountain question today. So in the there's this feature called the Great Meteor that passed underneath the Northeast that created the Adirondacks and the White Mountains, and you can read about that, but it's kind of not easy to see when you look at like Google Earth or something like that. But when these mountains were formed, the mountains have different shapes, and I was wondering if you could talk about how these shapes occurred. Like in the Green Mountains and the Berkshires, you can tell it's tectonic folds that you can easily see when you look at bedrock. But in the Adirondacks, it's all kind of jumbled, and some of the mountains in the south almost look like pillow. I call them pillows that kind of billow up from the ground.
Right.
I had a geology class, and the geologist called it they're like ice cubes that float on the surface of water. But I was just wondering why the Adirondacks have different mountain shapes, like the High Peaks versus the Central and South Adirondacks. I wanted to get an opinion about that.
Yeah, well, basically what happens is the Adirondacks form deep in the earth, and there was a lot of pressure on them. When they get to the surface, the rock expands because the pressure is no longer on it, and you get what's called exfoliation, which is effectively the same thing you get off your skin, is that the rock cracks parallel to the surface of the earth, and then those pieces fall off. So you wind up getting haystack-shaped mountains.
Interesting.
That's where that comes from. Now, it's most common in a homogeneous rock, a rock which is pretty well the same all over the place, so therefore it breaks in the same direction in all places. If you go to the Green Mountains or other places like that where the rock is not homogeneous, then other processes become more important, such as faulting and folding.
What is the primary rock in the Adirondacks?
It's called an orthosite. It's actually the same rock that's found on the moon.
Oh, really?
Yep.
Now, I had heard a long time ago, and maybe I heard incorrectly, that the Adirondacks were among the fastest growing mountain range in the world.
Well, the fastest growing mountain range is actually in Iraq, I think, or Iran, called the Zagros Mountains. They're actually rising so fast that the rivers can't keep up with them. The Adirondacks are rising. That was shown a number of years ago by very, very accurate measurements on Mount Marcy. So it's important that if you're going to climb them, you should climb them soon.
Or you have to climb them every year to say that you've been on the highest peak in New York.
That's correct. It gets higher every year.
Such a wise guy. One more call here. Jesse and Troy. Jesse, you're on.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I had a question about seltzer. So you learn in school that solubility increases with temperature of solutions, but the opposite is true with carbon dioxide as it dissolves into water to make seltzer. When you're carbonating, you have to get the water really cold to get a really good carbonation. And I was wondering if you could explain why that's the case.
In 50 seconds.
Yes. It's different if you're trying to dissolve a gas or if you're trying to dissolve a solid. If you're trying to dissolve a solid, generally hotter is better, not always, but generally, because shaking around the molecules is good for that. For a gas, hotter means that you tend to drive the gas out. The gas molecules are bouncing around, they get to the surface, and they escape.
And if you think about fishing, you don't want to fish in really hot water because the fish can't breathe oxygen because the oxygen has been depleted from the water.
Yep.
All right. Well, that's where we will have to leave it today. Thanks to Barbara Brabets, Ed Stander, and Jim Pickett for being here. Thanks to everybody who called in. Sorry if you didn't make it through. We almost got through all the calls. A few of you, sorry about that. We'll get you next time. Support comes from the Lake George Land Conservancy, Bolton Landing, New York, celebrating 30 years of protecting the land that protects the lake, offering more than 35 miles of trails for hiking, birding, and outdoor exploration, lglc.org. Hadley Garden Center, Hadley, Massachusetts, locally owned and operated for over 50 years with indoor and outdoor plants, gardening supplies, bird feeders and seeds, organic fertilizer and advice, hadleygardencenter.com. And Identity Eyewear, Albany, New York, specializing in distinctive eyewear, European styling, and prescription and non-prescription sunglasses, eye exams by appointment, EYEDENTITY, eyewearalbany.com. Well, that's it for today on Vox Pop. Thank you for joining us. Thanks to our engineer, Zach Malloy. Dina Salzman took the calls today. Our producer is Jim Lavoulis. I'm Ray Graff. Tomorrow on Food Friday, we will have a trio of cooks in the studio for a discussion of whole animal cooking. If you're intrigued, tune in tomorrow at 2 for a Food Friday. Right now, stand by for news.